Don't start my time yet. We got to find this. Okay, ready, go. Good morning, everybody. So I'm Gary Slutkin. I want to say that following this presentation, there will be a workshop on the ceasefire method that our Chief Operating Officer and Program Director Candace Kane is leading with Frank Perez, our outreach trainer and director, our two data and evaluation experts, Tim Metzger and Charlie Ransford, and two violence interrupters, Alfonso Prater and Amina Matthews. So they'll be going into more depth as to how this works. I'm going to be talking about the thinking that has gone into the design and development of a new intervention for reducing violence, which we're calling ceasefire. I will spend a very short amount of time on what it looks like in the field, and we'll end up with the results of the National Institute for Justice independent external evaluation, which has pretty much documented this as evidence-based practice and a proven method for reducing shootings and killings in neighborhoods. This is our landscape. This is the environment in which we have intentionally designed, developed, piloted, and replicated an intervention which was not based on individual outcomes but on community-level outcomes of reducing the overall numbers of shootings and killings in neighborhoods. You can see the geographic, what we call spatial clustering of the problem. The red are deaths, the red bodies are deaths, and the black guns are non-fatal events. Again, the clustering, typical of any epidemic event. Just to point out that Chicago's rate density of killings, it is surpassed by nearly 30 other cities in the United States. That's to say, they have over 25 cities have rates that are worse than Chicago's now. The impact of violence, well known to most of the people here, but the high relevance of highlighting this is the idea that if should we be able to reverse this epidemic and put it behind us, as we have so many other epidemic problems, these would be some of the things that we would no longer have to deal with. So we began to look at this problem from a scientific angle. In other words, we in health, I'm a health guy, we in health have made mistakes many, many times, as the general public has, in condemning populations, whether they had cancer, they were considered bad people at one time. People with tuberculosis were once considered bad people. People with mental health very recently, and in many countries around the world, many mental health disorders are considered bad people. Alcoholism was considered something of bad people, and now we realize that these were all diseases. And in fact, there is no science at all to good people and bad people. There's no science at all to this. These are all events which are undesirable or desirable events. We really had a lot of trouble with this in the AIDS issue. So if we were to understand this scientifically, what would we say? We would be looking at two sciences, principally two sciences, the sciences of behavior and the sciences of epidemics or epidemiology or the distribution of events, the characteristics of the events, how it's transmitted, how it forms. And just staying with behavior for a minute, we would be asking the questions, how are behaviors formed? Would that be an important question? How are behaviors formed, and how are they maintained? How are behaviors maintained, and how are they changed? All behaviors, including violence. Violence is a different behavior. No, violence is a behavior, like sexual behavior, violence behavior, cigarette smoking behavior, drinking behavior, eating behavior. These are behaviors. Many of these behaviors have been thought to be somehow different. So if we try to answer these questions crisply under time pressures, we would say that the literature essentially shows that most behaviors, including violent behaviors, are formed. They're acquired. And how? Not by classroom learning, but by observation, by imitation, by copying. There's even neurons in the brain that unconsciously see something and do the same thing, repeat it. So very young children are both consciously and unconsciously looking to their older brothers and to the community around for what it is that is expected of me. And what maintains these behaviors are these expectations of peers. Peer expectations are what drive most behaviors. And it isn't just peer pressure, it's fear. It's fear of not doing what's expected of you. I had an epiphany when I was working on AIDS, that is to say sexual behavior, that the principal determinant of whether someone uses a condom is whether they think their friends use it. The principal, what a way to make a decision about your life, but soon it becomes unconscious. The principal determinant of whether a mom breastfeeds is whether the other moms do. The principal determinant of my dress behavior today is what I think you expect of me. Therefore, I am not here in a bathing suit. I am completely I am afraid to do that. It isn't just social pressure. So this is what is normal. What is normal in this room is a certain type of dress. Also notice that nobody's smoking here, whereas when I was in medical school, a third of us were smoking at conferences like this, even doctors in training. So the norm or the social expectation can be changed by behavior change methods to which we're beginning to apply to the science of this field. And then the other business or science to be applied is that of epidemic control. Now, what about epidemics and violence? Well, here's the most extreme example of an epidemic. This is a cholera epidemic. Why is he talking about cholera? Look at the curve. A point source epidemic, suddenly an infection from dirty water, from contaminated water, affects one population, and then there's a secondary curve here of a new susceptible population. Those are refugees that came in and they became infected secondarily. Well, here's a killing curve, looking very much the same. This is from Rwanda, an extreme example of violence appearing in an epidemic wave, with a second wave also, in this case, a population that was hiding being found, being newly susceptible and newly responding to this. And in fact, almost all of the killing curves show the same wave characteristics, the same infectivity, the same transmission characteristics, the same incubation period, variabilities, dormancy, and susceptibilities of populations, and relapse characteristics. So, how are epidemics reversed? Would you like to know? It so happens that there's really only two things we do, and everybody thinks that it is so incredibly scientific, but it's a science of how to apply strategy rather than just a science of, for example, chemotherapy or antibiotics, which are frequently a small part of strategy, as you're noting with the flu epidemic now. So these are the two things that we do in controlling epidemics. We interrupt transmission and we change norms. How we interrupt transmission varies by the transmission characteristics. How we change the behavior norms have a lot of simplified, generalizable characteristics, but uses different messengers. Interrupting transmission. Well, if this were measles we were talking about, or polio, the interrupting point would be done by vaccine. If this were TB, I worked in TB for several years, what we do is we find and treat the most infectious people to render their sputum non-infectious so they no longer can infect other people. What we're doing now in ceasefire is using violence interrupters who have the special abilities through our recruiting and training and selecting and supervising and supporting this new professional cadre of worker so that they can both detect and interrupt this transmission. And then, of course, we have to do something continuously with that person because they've self-identified as a potential transmitter in the future, and we have to find more of them. Likewise, changing social norms. Now, what is a social norm? Well, a social norm is what everybody else is doing. Well, why are they doing that? Well, they're doing it because everybody else is doing it. Well, why is he doing it? It's because everybody else is doing it. So how do you change the norms? Well, it's principally by changing social expectations, which requires the use of credible messengers and multiple messengers through a management system. And this is how many other behaviors, especially in our international environment, have been changed. So what does it look like? Here are violence interrupters, and you'll learn more about them in the workshop. How are the norms changed? Violence interrupters and outreach workers, both interrupting conflicts and working on the norm change. And then through a series of messengers, systematically involved in both the social expectation change and the messaging by multiple other lines of communication to change perception of risk, which is social risk, as well as having an on-the-spot alternative, which is frequently face-saving. And so these are the other pieces that you'll hear more about in the workshop that have to do with the community itself as a messenger, having a response to every single shooting in a ceasefire zone, involving the clergy who are also trained to be messengers, effective for some and not for others, and then a public education campaign as for smoking, as for drunk driving, as for any behavior that you're trying to change. So what does it look like? Well, here's one of our first neighborhoods. Look at the seasonality, shootings per neighborhood, when the program begins, the drop in the plateaus. This is the Logan Square neighborhood, a number of plateaus dropping off when the program starts. Here's the program is doubled, and here are two more interrupters added, and you can see the dose response characteristics of the intervention. Another community, the first 12 communities. Here's our data, which we were tracking before the external evaluation. I'm going to show you the first 18 communities. These are the first six with three sets of comparisons, including rate-controlled, contiguous neighborhoods, and the city as a whole, all statistical at the 0.01 level, measuring shootings and killings combined. The next eight communities, and then the last four. These are all 18, no cherry-picking. And here is the beginnings of the introduction to the external evaluation that NIJ funded, that Wes Scogin was lead author. This is a three-year study covering eight communities over 7 years of intervention with a baseline that extended for much longer than that. Four universities were involved. Four different types of statistical analysis were used on this. Every single statistical method that was applied to this showed a statistical result, and every community had a statistical result. Time series analysis, hotspot mapping, gang network analysis looking at retaliation murders, and intensive confidential interviews with the highest risk people. There's materials on this that will be available at the workshop as well. So this is now a proven method to reduce shootings and killings in neighborhoods and to make neighborhoods safer. It reduces shootings and killings. These are hot spots. This is from the evaluation, becoming cooler. These are the drops in reciprocal murders. The interrupters are nearly 100% at preventing retaliation murders. Two other neighborhoods are showing 46 and 50% drops. Five out of eight showed 100% drop in retaliation murders. If they know about it, they stop it. They know about the potential. These are individual outcomes of clients, the highest risk clients, which is confirmed by the study that they were. These are not referrals from school, referrals from court, referrals from probation or parole. These are the people who are street information are those who are involved right now and most at risk of actually doing an event. But the main thing about the intervention is that its outcomes were community-wide. And what I'm trying to put forward here is that there is a difference between reducing recidivism or getting someone out of a gang, of which there have been many different experiences, versus having a community-level drop in shootings and killings. So we have systems for replication of this, which I will not go through here, but they include the hiring of new types of workers, interrupters, outreach workers, coordinators, canvassers, and others who are involved in the pieces of the work, the different, just like any immunization program or a TB program, this is now a coming profession, a new profession, which the community works and the city works. So the opportunity we feel now is to develop a learning partnership around this. Our goals now are to work with the National Institute for Justice and DOJ and others to develop a learning partnership to even to improve this more, to learn more from it and expand it with five or six cities at the center who are very serious about its adaptation and where together we can get the resources to apply it. If you take the percent reductions that this intervention has shown in multiple communities now through multiple methods and extrapolate it to citywide application in any of the major cities that have very, very serious problems, or those who have moderately serious problems, an enormous impact, probably on the order of between 40 and 60% drops, might be expected to be seen if put to full coverage in communities. And the savings, not to mention the life savings, would be transformative. Thank you very much.